This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
Welcome to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO. My name is Carla. I'll be your host for the show this evening. And tonight we're going to be featuring a couple of different segments for our show. In a little bit, we'll be speaking with Saucity, who is the creative mastermind behind Dirty Queer. She's also the host of Dirty Queer, which is the X-rated queer open mic that is celebrating 6 years of dirtiness on this Friday evening. We'll be hearing from Saucity as well as playing some samples from a past Dirty Queer show. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be hearing from Kristen Yount, which is a new contributor to Out Loud Radio Show. Kristen interviewed author Chris Denali, the book title You Are Here, and we'll be hearing from that author later in the second half of the show. But before we get to our first segment, I want to let you know how to connect with Out Loud Radio on the internet. First of all, if you connect on Facebook, you can find Out Loud Radio on Facebook. We are also part of the Twitter world. You can find KBOO Out Loud on Twitter as well. And we love to hear from our listeners. You can email us directly at outloudradio@gmail.com. We love to get feedback from our listeners. We also appreciate any news tips that you might have, or perhaps ideas for future radio shows, or perhaps you'd like to get involved. Feel free to email us at outloudradio@gmail.com. Now, we'll be back in just a few moments to speak with Saucity and to learn more about Dirty Queer. But first, let's take a music break. The song we're going to hear is from a local artist. Christine Havrilla was based on the East Coast for many, many years, but she's here in Portland now. And Christine is going to be playing a show this weekend on Sunday, January 13th. It's an early show from 6 to 8 p.m. happening at Mississippi Pizza Pub, which is located at 3552 North Mississippi Avenue, just a few blocks north of Fremont. And this is a show that has no cover charge. There is a suggested donation for the musicians, perhaps $5 to $10 if you can, but there is no cover. Again, the show is on this coming Sunday, January 13th, 6 to 8 p.m. at Mississippi Pizza Pub. Christine Havrilla is playing as a duo. She goes by the name Gypsy Fuzz when she has someone with her. But the song that we're about to hear is from Christine's solo album titled In My Chair. The song we're about to hear from Christine Havrilla is titled Daffodil.
Thank you for singing. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Welcome back to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show here on KBOO. The song we were just hearing was titled Daffodil from the artist Christine Havrilla. Christine is going to be playing here in Portland on Sunday evening, this coming Sunday, January 13th, from 6 to 8 p.m. It's one of the early shows over at Mississippi Pizza Pub, which is located at 3552 North Mississippi Avenue. That's just a few blocks north of Fremont. So I want to say thank you so much to Christine for being a guest on past Out Loud radio shows, and we will see you at the show on Sunday night. Now, next, I want to move into a conversation about dirty queer, which is a topic that we've focused on and celebrated here on Out Loud in the past few years, and dirty queer is celebrating a significant milestone, 6 years of celebrating dirty queers. The celebration is happening this Friday evening at In Other Words. Again, it's happening Friday, January 11th from 6 to 9 p.m. at In Other Words, which is located at the corner of North Killingsworth and North Williams. And I would like to welcome Saucity to the show. And Saucity, are you with us?
I am indeed.
So welcome back to Out Loud. It's great to have you with us.
Oh, it's always great to be on Out Loud.
So for folks that aren't familiar with, I guess I announced Dirty Queer earlier in the show as being the X-rated queer open mic, and I don't think that that really gives it justice. I guess give us a little bit more perspective on what happens at Dirty Queer.
Well, it's kind of like a village hall, a town hall meeting, if you will, for folks that don't often get a place to air their particular special needs and desires. It's a place for people to explore sexuality in a healthy, supportive environment. You know, we're grown-ups doing grown-up things, and why don't we talk about it? Because having a conversation is at least as important as anything you might do afterwards.
That's it. And as we, you know, I'm naming it as an open mic, but I like how you said town hall, because most people think of an open mic as, you know, somebody standing at a microphone and talking. And, well, that certainly does happen at Dirty Queer. There have been many, many other types of performances that fall under the umbrella of Dirty Queer.
Indeed. Other types of performances and also conversations. And I don't just mean the ones at intermission, because, of course, polite Dirty Queers never talk while someone else is on the stage. But the conversations that happen at intermission and afterwards and beforehand, the conversations that happen days after or weeks after by something that was prompted that happened at Dirty Queer, and also the conversations that happen as a community in the sense of listening, participating in what's happening on stage, giving the full attention and giving feedback, holding that space. It's all a group effort. It's not a rock star situation. It's us listening to ourselves.
And that's, I really appreciate that you said that, the listening part, because I'll admit, I've been going to Dirty Queer as long as I can remember, and I've been, you know, I felt so many different emotions in the process of listening to what other people share. It's really hard to describe. One thing I love about Dirty Queer is the diversity, and I use the word queer, but many of the people who come, you know, who participate as just observers, but also people who perform or share whatever it is they want to share, they may or may not be identified as queer. So I really like the spectrum of people that show up in all the different ways that our community does show up every time there is a Dirty Queer event.
Indeed. I've had several people tell me that it feels like church. And as someone who was raised who put the word eclectic down under religion, church is not necessarily my first thought for that sort of group, but then again, if the idea is to gather together and be grateful and to have faith in what we can create together and to have an idea of a greater force that can move through us, then sure, Dirty Queer is church.
Right, and it's a special place that a lot of people go. Yes, and just as a shout out to anyone who's considering going this Friday, again, this we're celebrating 6 years of Dirty Queer is this Friday, again, January 11th. The publicity information talks about the event happening from 6 to 9. I suspect by quarter after six, the place is going to be packed.
It's going to be packed. It's actually going to be going till 10. Our anniversary format is a little different because anniversaries are special.
Mm-hmm.
So we usually run 6:30 to 9 approximately, but we're going to be running from 6 until 10. That first hour is snacks. We've got a couple of local businesses like New Seasons and Dovetail Bakery that are donating tasty treats. And we're also going to have a photo booth by Bloodhound Photography, which if you've been to a queer dance party in town, you've probably experienced Bloodhound Photography. They do amazing photos, so we're very excited about that. So that first hour is about mingling and chatting and the things that we don't usually get to do before Dirty Queer because we're just so excited to get there and try to find a seat. And you really should show up early, even if the only thing you want to do is find a seat. So I encourage you to snack and mingle and photograph and all those other fun things. And then we're going to have open mic in two segments. We're going to go from 7 to 8 for open mic, and then 8:30 to 9:30. We're going to take a whole half-hour intermission to stretch our legs and talk to that cutie across the aisle and, you know, the things we do on intermission. So it's exciting to be doing a larger format. I like to throw a special party on our anniversary.
Yes, it's very exciting. Now, do you need any volunteers or any other donations? Is there any way for folks to support the event that's coming up on Friday night?
Thank you for asking. One of the best ways to support is, of course, to donate, because proceeds from Dirty Queer do go towards supporting, in other words, which is an important resource. It is also going to be a great opportunity to impress other folks with your cooking skills. If anybody feels inspired to bring along something to share snack-wise, that would be great. And, of course, we always appreciate help setting up or breaking down afterwards, so in other words, volunteers aren't stuck with too much work.
Okay.
We do have a ton of sponsors, though. Usually we have two door prizes, but it's our anniversary, so we have four. And we also have a special sponsor for our Q&A. So we've got a lot of prizes for the evening. I've got gifts to give out from the Pencil Test, Ritual Arts, Pervert the Cirque, and Aster Wolf, who's a local massage therapist, and then our Q&A is sponsored by Slow Jams, which is a local company that makes jam very slowly, small batches, amazing flavors. So just by showing up and donating and being in the room, you have a chance at some great prizes.
That sounds like such a good time. I just want to catch up any listeners that are just joining the conversation. You're listening to Out Loud. This is the Queer Culture Radio Show on KBOO. My name is Carla, and we're speaking with Saucity, who I call the creative mastermind, as well as the host of Dirty Queer, which is the X-rated queer open mic. This Friday, January 11th, Dirty Queer is celebrating their six-year anniversary, and this is happening at In Other Words, the Feminist Bookstore and Community Center, located on the corner of North Killingsworth and North Williams. The website for In Other Words is inotherwords.org, and the website for Dirty Queer is dirtyqueer, is it .com or
.org? Yep, okay. It's .com.
Dirtyqueer.com. And are there other ways for, if folks cannot join the celebration on Friday evening, what are ways that folks can find or get engaged with Dirty Queer into the future?
Well, we do have a mailing list, which is a good idea to sign up, find out what else is going on. We do have a podcast. I'm currently working to get the last couple of years up online, but it will be possible to soon listen to all of the podcasts that we have. But at the very least, you could tune into the first couple of years in the privacy of your own home, which works better for some people. We got some folks who are shy, and there are a couple of spots kind of behind the bookcase where people can stand if they need a little space during the evening. It's a lot of energy in the room. I definitely understand that. And then there's lots of other events that happen that Dirty Queer supports and that I'm a part of, like Pervert the Cirque. The Queer Femme Porn Tour is coming through on February 10th. So there's other related events, and then I'm also going to be doing a writing workshop series pretty soon on queer, fat, disabled, working class bodies. Those are four different workshops there. But there's lots of stuff coming up, so you definitely want to get on the mailing list to keep informed. And then, of course, we're on a quarterly format now, so the next Dirty Queer after this will be April 12th.
Okay. And I'm going to guess, are most of those details you just shared on the dirtyqueer.com website?
They are, and on Facebook. We're really easy to find there as well.
Okay, I was going to ask about Facebook. So, yeah, shout out to everyone who connects or networks or whatever you use Facebook for. You can find Dirty Queer on Facebook as well.
Absolutely.
Now,
and we do go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say we have just a limited amount of time left. And so I wanted to ask, you know, I know you're very involved with other projects, and I want to invite you to come back and share more about your writing workshops and more of the different work that you do in the community. But was there anything else that you wanted to share with our listeners, or any closing thoughts that you want to leave with people?
Sure. I'm really excited. We're about to put out an anthology, a Dirty Queer anthology. It's been a really interesting process, but I've gathered together some amazing pieces, and we have a cover that's being designed by a local artist, Christopher Mack, and I'm really excited about our foreword, which is being done by Sinclair Sexsmith. So I'll have more info about that anthology at the event on Friday.
Okay, that's awesome. Now, again, listeners, I hate to say it, but we have to say goodbye to Saucity. But Saucity, please come back and join us on the show again in the future, and we'll talk more about your writing and the anthology and all that other tasty stuff that you've been working on.
I'm very excited about it. Thanks for having me, Carla.
All right, thank you. Keep up the good work, and we'll see you on Friday.
Thanks so much. I'll see you then.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, those details again, listeners, hopefully you've got a pencil handy. The Dirty Queer 6-year anniversary celebration is this Friday, January 11th from 6 until 10 p.m. at In Other Words, which is located at the corner of North Killingsworth and North Williams. Two websites for more information. You can go to dirtyqueer.com, or you can also go to inotherwords.com. And Saucity did just share with us, she'll be doing those writing workshops, and the anthology is coming out soon. And Saucity is just a social justice genius. And so we will have her back on the show in the future to talk more about those other projects. Now, we're going to take a music break, and we'll be back in just a few moments with more Out Loud Radio. For now, let's go to Billy Bragg singing about sexuality.
was laying in bed the other night, talking to the Lord, the way I do. And I looked up into the heavens and I said, Lord,
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 I've got just one question for you before I die. And it goes a little something like this. Is it okay to be gay in heaven? Is it okay to be queer when you are here?
The white guy with a beard handed me a beer
and said it is okay to be a queer when you are here. Take her tongue for a ride on the streets of gold by and by.
Yeah, it's okay to be gay in heaven. Yeah, it's okay to be queer when you are here.
Will a triangle wait upon the pearly gate to the door to the portal of the Lord? 'Cause I want to marry Mary. She's all natural. Take her tongue for a ride on the streets of gold by and by. Now I am Jesus' stepmom.
Welcome back to Out Loud, the queer culture radio show on KBOO Portland. My name is Carla. The song that you just heard was called Gay Country Song, and the group was called Glitter Fruit. Glitter Fruit has performed in the past at Dirty Queer, and the songs that they perform at Dirty Queer we cannot play on the radio during this time frame. The FCC would not like that. But the Gay Country Song was a little campy, and I just wanted to give you a little sample of what you might enjoy if you decide to go to Dirty Queer, which is happening this Friday, again, January 11th, from 6 to 10 p.m. at In Other Words. Again, that song was from Glitter Fruit, which is based here in Portland. Before that, we heard a song titled Sexuality from Billy Bragg. Again, that all connects to the conversation that we had with Saucity, talking about Dirty Queer, the X-rated queer open mic, which is one of my favorite events here in Portland. It's always a good time. Now, we need to segue into our next interview for the show this evening, and we're going to be moving into a conversation with a book author, and I'm going to say goodbye for the evening, and the rest of the show is going to be hosted by Kristen Yount, which is another KBOO volunteer, and this is Kristen's first contribution to Out Loud, but this is a great example where Out Loud welcomes contributions from anyone who would like to be part of this show, and everyone on the air is a volunteer. We also want to say a huge thank you to Liam, our engineer in the control room. He pushes all the bells and whistles and gets this thing broadcast for us. So thank you, Liam. And also thank you to all the other volunteers that help make Out Loud happen. Now we're moving into an author interview. The book is titled You Are Here, and the author's name is Chris Delaney. And here is an interview from Kristen Yount.
This is Kristen Yount with KBOO Out Loud, speaking tonight with author Chris Delaney, and he has written a book called You Are Here. It's, well, I'll let Mr. Delaney tell you what it's about. Why don't you give us a little bit of information about your book?
Sure. First of all, thank you very much for having me on your show. It is about a young painter who moves to San Francisco to sort of get away from a family tragedy, and all he wants to do is sort of get through life just, on his own, just do his own thing, painting, making practically no money. But even in the course of that, even as he tries to sort of isolate himself, he finds himself getting involved with two other guys who are, would be the last people that he would think to ever get involved with. But little by little, slowly he gets into their lives, and it affects him, it affects them, and it sort of goes from there. It's sort of an unusual sort of love triangle is how I would describe it.
Yeah, it seems like the main character, Peter, is he's older. I mean, he's in his mid-20s, right? and he goes
right,
to...
Right, yeah, he's just shy. Yeah, I put him, I don't really give his exact age, but he's like 24, 25. And by today's standards, he's actually, you know, kids are coming out younger and younger, and Peter's actually sort of at the older end of that spectrum. Sort of in his situation is that he was actually living at home, didn't really have the freedom that he wanted, just to sort of be himself and to paint. So he, you know, he gets out and he, you know, he moves to California to sort of get away from all that. So yeah, he's a little bit older, but awfully naive and sort of not very willing to grow up. He's, you know, he's kind of immature. I mean, he's a nice guy and all that, but you know, he needs to strike out on his own in order to grow up. And at the beginning of the novel, I'm not sure if he quite realizes what growing up actually entails, and that is his journey in this novel.
Yeah, for sure. It seems like he was just isolated and sort of content with being on his own, exploring his feelings and his place in the world, and then all of a sudden he realizes that he's going to have to reach out and make connections with people in order to be fully actualized. So,
yeah.
And it seems like he's sort of unwilling at first, but yet tantalized by the idea of doing it, right?
Exactly, exactly. And you know, his decision at the very beginning of the book just to go on that one date with that one with one guy.
The Donald.
You know, not a, with Donald, right, exactly. You know, he makes a decision. He does it anyway, even though he doesn't think it's going to go in a good place, which it certainly doesn't, but that sort of that, you know, from that near disaster of a date, you know, it starts the ball rolling for him. Ultimately, that decision, you could look at, I mean, on the one hand, it was a, you know, terrible idea to go out on that date, but in the long run, it's what helps him. It's the thing that gets the ball rolling for him.
Yeah, without giving too much away, he definitely, it was scary reading that part. I was like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen?
Yeah, you know, I was scared when I wrote it. I personally have never gone through anything that goes into that. And that was actually a lot of the writing of the book. There's a lot that happens in that book that I'm happy to say I have never experienced. But as a writer, just sort of getting, you know, putting the character into that situation and then putting myself into the shoes of that character. I mean, I felt physically afraid, you know, just for myself, like I'm in an uncomfortable place. You know, I think I read Dorothy Allison, who said that when you write that sort of thing, your fear becomes your friend. When you're afraid, when you feel fear when you're writing, it's actually your friend. That's the sign that you're actually heading in a place where, you know, the fiction needs to be in order to get people interested in reading it. So, yeah, without giving too much away, I feel your fear. I felt the same way when I wrote it.
That's great. And I, you know, when I was reading the book, I felt like, wow, these are, you really go into the character analysis. When you're reading the book, it seems like, oh, I'm getting to know these people. I'm getting to care about what they think and the directions that their lives are taking. You invest in the characters. And I was just thinking that you live in San Francisco. How did your friends like the book?
Mostly the comments have been positive. People are, you know, they you know, particularly on the personal level, they're always, you know, they're looking to see if they themselves are actually in the novel and who is this and who is that.
So right.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting when they ask that, and I insist that has nothing to do with them. And you know, when it comes to, I mean, I don't want to write about real people. I mean, you know, it's interesting that you say that. You know, you were, when you read it, you got to know the characters as you went along, because what I've learned as a writer is that's how novels get written. Is that I don't conceive the characters ahead of time and then just put it in there. You know, I conceive some of the characters, but a part of the character analysis for each character, but in a way, I got to know the characters myself as I was writing it. And what I've learned is that sometimes, you know, it's sort of like not knowing about the characters is kind of a better way to approach to writing a novel, because, you know, as I get to, my process of writing it is the same way that I want my readers to get to know the characters as it goes along. So, you know, so in that respect, they were, you know, in a way, all the characters are complete strangers to me. And even now, like when I read it, I think, okay, you know, who are these people? You know, it's you know, maybe my attitude toward them will change, you know, 5 years from now when I revisit the book. So, no, that's an interesting question.
Everyone, oh, yeah. Well, I wasn't sure if I was going to ask you that, but it sort of just went there, so.
don't hesitate to ask anything.
That's great.
Yeah.
You know, originally when I got the book to read, it was, I know that Prop 8 was.
Yes.
So
I was working on the book when Prop 8 was happening. So I have a partner. We got married in August of 2008, and then a few weeks after that, you know, we went on our honeymoon, and you know, we got back from the honeymoon, and then we found out that the the initiative was tied, and you know, we were going into the election, and I was working on this book, and I thought to myself, okay, I will make, you know, I'll make lemonade out of this lemon if Prop 8 happens, and it did, unfortunately, and. When it did pass, you know, I sort of made it a central theme of this novel, especially in the predicament of the character of Miles, who, you know, he has a fiancé, then he suddenly doesn't have a fiancé, and then Prop 8 passes, and now he feels like, you know, the door has been shut on him forever. You know, I fully believe that, you know, Prop 8 will be overturned in California one way or the other, whether through the courts or the ballot. I think, you know, it will eventually go away. And so I saw this as the opportunity. This is like the one opportunity to, you know, to set a book in 2008 with a character who has this predicament, because, you know, future books that I write, my characters will not have that predicament. They'll have other predicaments related to, you know, when marriage becomes available to them. So that's kind of how I reacted to it. I'll tell you, Prop 8, it was a horrible. I still remember the day after the election, waking up and. You know, on the one hand, Obama had just won this historic election, but at the same time, California voters had voted down Proposition 8. It was a truly devastating thing. I can't remember feeling just so, you know, personally insulted and, you know, depressed by the fact that that measure had passed. It's, you know, I think it'll always be a black mark on California history.
Wow, yeah, definitely. Wow.
So, hey, but, you know, that which does not kill you, you know, I have a friend on a fiction website who's one of my favorite people. One of her models is, you know, that which does not kill you makes great fiction. So with that motto in mind, I proceeded to rewrite my book to update it to make it specific to 2008, specifically after that election.
So there was probably a very... morose time in the community where people were
yeah, morose isn't even the word for it. I think it was frustration, you know, attending protest rallies, protesting, the shame of Prop 8. It was just frustration. It's just the idea that people, you know, of course I campaigned against Prop 8. Even the fact that I had to campaign for my rights, that I actually have a standout on a street corner, you know, campaigning for people to protect a right that I shouldn't have to campaign for. I saw, you know, a lot of the arrogance of the Yes on 8. I remember standing on the corner, and I remember like a car, you know, sort of slowing down. It was a big old car, and a woman leaning out of the passenger seat and calling out to me, "I'm voting yes." I just remember thinking, "Oh, you are. What a horrible, ignorant woman you are." And it, you know, that's the face of the Yes on 8 campaign that I remember.
Right.
And even now, it's been 4 long years since that measure passed. To think that side is the side that won, you know, that actually, you know, there were more of her out there than there were of me out there voting in 2008 to, you know, to strip gays and lesbians of their right to be married.
So.
Yeah, very hurtful.
Yeah, that's the face of the Yes on 8, Prop 8. That's a very good, frightening way to put it, because it is, after all, people who are deciding what's right and what's wrong, and that, yeah. You know, I would think that your fellow Californians and your fellow city people in your city, it would be very disgraceful, and it would make me feel terrible to know that I'm sharing a sidewalk with someone who doesn't think my rights matter or my happiness right. matters, and that's devastating, especially in this day and age. It's horrifying.
Yeah, yeah. But, time goes by, so quickly. I mean, I was following, so the campaigns is just such a relief to see that, progress is always going forward. I mean, the experience in California, was not the end of the debate. I think it just, merely moved the debate forward. I think, in the elections of 2012 that you saw, in Maine and in Maryland and in Washington to expand rights for gays and lesbians, I think, I would like to think that the voters in those states saw the experience of California, and enough of them saw that and decided they did not want to share in that disgrace, that they wanted to, actually move the cause of human rights forward. And they did. So that's why I'm feeling very hopeful that, that California will, same-sex marriage will come back to California, whether you like it or not. And, and in terms of fiction, I'm actually looking forward to for the right to marry to be spread to gays and lesbians, because I think it'll open up a lot of fictional possibilities, what it actually means to get married. It really is, when I got married, it really is, I got domestic, we got domestically partnered, I think, in 2003 or 2004. We were married in 2008, and I just remember thinking, going through the ceremony and saying my vows and just really realizing that marriage really is in a different category. It's just, it's just much more serious. There's just a lot more at stake, and from the fictional standpoint, at least, I think it'll open up a lot of possibilities when marriage really does become legal for gays and lesbians. I think gay writers will be writing a lot of great fiction around this new choice that we all have. So, but that's the future.
That's so cool, and yeah, I definitely think that we should all be hopeful. And I think that there's plenty of room for paradigm shifts in this world, and this is just, one really important one, and there's always got to be some back and forth before that happens. So, I would definitely just look at this as it's a drag that we have to keep struggling, but can still...
That's the course of human history.
Yep,
the course
definitely.
Of true love never ran smooth, I think is how that goes. The course of true love never did run smooth. That's how the line goes. Anyway.
Yeah. So I noticed that, like in the characters. I mean, this you sort of were going for a Jane Austen type of novel, right? So it's intriguing, and you have characters that are sort of like superficial and flighty and kind of and then you have these other characters with these deep emotional needs to be fulfilled, like wanting to belong and wanting to be cared for and nurtured by their partner. Am I wrong? So tell me a little bit about
that's
that.
Very close. I mean, Jane Austen is one of the, one of my absolute, one of my fictional heroes. I mean, the cardinal sin in Jane Austen novels is sort of a lack of self-awareness, when you just, you're just sort of going through life and sort of living for yourself and not really thinking deeply about how, you fit in and how, how everything works. I mean, this book isn't based on anything by her. But there is one, there is one thing, her novel, Mansfield Park, which was the first novel that I really just, that is my favorite of her novels and one of my favorite novels of all time. There is a story arc in there where, this character, he's rich, he's smug, he's unpleasant, and the heroine in that, she's very sweet, she's very gentle, and she really doesn't like him at all. And he winds up falling in love with her and sort of makes a project of trying to win her heart. And I've always been intrigued by that notion about the man who has everything, the man who could have any woman he wants, or in this case, the man who could have any man he wants, winds up falling for the one person who just simply doesn't care for him. He sort of knows the truth about him and doesn't care, and that's what he finds so intriguing. And that is something that that arc in that story is one that has me. It really hit something inside with me, and that really sort of became the very beginning germ of what ultimately became this book. Sort of, you know, the plot in my book is, you know, doesn't come close to. I've done so many rewrites that it's not even close to Mansfield Park. But that one thing remains. The one that would be the case of the third character, Nick, who's, you know, he's good looking and he's smart and he makes a ton of money, but you know, all the same, he's kind of a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
Winds up sort of almost by accident, sort of getting himself involved with Peter by you know through sort of a very sort of selfish, thoughtless project on his own. Sort of winds up getting involved with Peter. That is kind of what got it started. That was the beginning part of it, and then I moved forward and then got to know the characters as I went along. Sort of ironically, the character of Nick, biographically, my own biography is actually, I'm not sure what this says about me, but I actually come the closest to Nick. I mean, he's got, you know, he's Greek-American, he grew up in Boston, you know, those sorts of details, which, you know, pulling for details, I actually gave them to Nick. And so, you know, I'm not sure, like I said, I don't know what it says about me, but I'm actually closest, the character I probably resemble the most is the biggest jerk in the novel. I don't know what that's.
I noticed that because I read your bio and yeah. I was like, oh, so because you are writing in the third person, so you have, right? It's just this whole.
Yeah, third person, yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of, that's just it. It's like I kind of, but at the same time, I didn't want that character to be like a cartoon. I wanted him to be relatable. And I think a lot of the decisions that he makes and the situation that he's in, you know, just sort of when I put myself in his shoes, I just sort of, you know, that was, you know, part of the fear is, you know, just sort of putting myself, literally myself, into a character that, you know, whose worldview is not necessarily one that I espouse, but at the same time, you know, ultimately, and this is kind of one of the things about, you know, working on a novel is that, you know, when you know putting yourself in the shoes of completely another character and they make a decision that you yourself wouldn't necessarily make, I mean it's like a real big it's like a leap of generosity. I don't know
True.
How to put it, because it's like because you're saying, well, you know characters make, you know, a character might make a decision that you don't necessarily make. That's just it. It's like you put yourself in the other character and you just sort of see what that character is doing and you sort of observe that. That's what I do as a writer, just sort of observe it and say, okay. And then that leads to the ultimate question, which is kind of the scariest thing for writers, is to say, well, God, if I really were in that person's position, would I make that decision? And I honestly wouldn't be able to say I would or I wouldn't. So that's kind of the thing to do. It's not trying to. That's kind of one of the biggest challenges for me as a novelist is to just sort of observe and not to judge and just sort of let the characters, you know, do what they're going to do and see what comes of it. And then after it's all done, take a look at everything and decide what it all means. So that was my process when I wrote this book. And that was, and what made it kind of interesting for me with the character of Nick was to put my own biography, you know, put all pieces of my biography into his character. And so I'm closer to that character than I realize. That's kind of how I got to know that character. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's almost like you had to internalize the jerk a little bit in order to make him, like, have a heart. Because he wasn't, like, Donald. He was more.
No, no.
He was his own
right.
guy.
Definitely someone I don't. You know.
Yeah.
He definitely makes decisions that I would never ever make.
No. Well, he was crooked. But Nick, I mean, he did some jerky things, but you still felt you could empathize with Nick. I mean, even though he made
Little
some
bit,
bad
yeah.
moves, you could tell that his heart was breaking over it, and that he felt bad and wasn't completely. Not thinking
right.
about Peter,
which
you know.
Kind of, you know, that's life for you. I mean, we're not all good and we're not all bad, and sometimes we make the right decision and sometimes we make the wrong decision. And, you know, that's how life goes. And, you know, for most of us, if you make a wrong decision, I mean, the best you do is you look back and, you know, realize the mistake and try to learn from it and grow from it. And kind of, I mean, not to give too much away. I mean, that's kind of Nick's challenge at the end of the book is sort of, you know, what what is his character going to do? Does he learn? Did he learn? I mean, that's the part that I'm not sure I know the answer to, which is kind of why I left it unanswered.
Yeah, and it seems like he could go either way, really. I mean, is he so regimented in his lifestyle that he can't find any other way to be? And that's kind of tragic. And just seeing that Peter could have definitely gone that way, but he didn't. And I really just want to say that the way that you incorporated his artwork into the his success at the end, the artwork as a metaphor throughout the book, I thought was a really wonderful thing. And I don't think I'm giving too much away because...
No.
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, Peter making Peter an artist, that's definitely a sort of wishful thinking on my part. Like, I can barely draw better than a stick figure. But I've always been, just a huge fan of all sorts of art, visiting museums, the chalkboard drawing that he begins, draws at the beginning of the book is, sort of a parody of one of my favorite paintings of all time. And the artwork, but this I'll say is that, whatever art you're into, whether it be, painting or writing or music or dance or whatever, the part that Peter learned, the lesson that Peter learns is the lesson that I have learned working on my fiction, which is, you really can't make art about the world unless you are actually in the world, part of the world. And that's something, he doesn't realize at the beginning of the book, but does, gradually learns over the course of the book, almost without his even realizing it. So, yeah.
Right, when
I
he gets
the... I love writing about art. I love reading about art. It's one of my passions.
He gets the big commission from his roommate, and he says, oh, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but then it ends up being so perfect.
Right.
So let's go back to Prop 8 a little bit, for our listeners who may not be up on what's going on with Prop 8. You said that... And maybe you don't know, but what is going on with the courts? Is it being challenged
right now,
in the courts?
Right. I mean, I follow them. Proposition 8 is now has made it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, it's been declared unconstitutional first by a federal judge and then by the U.S. Appellate Court here in San Francisco. And now the case has been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court, along with so Proposition 8 has been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court, and then also a provision of the Defense of Marriage Act based on a woman, actually a very fascinating woman, who lives in New York. So both of those cases are being heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think the Supreme Court will rule. In oral arguments haven't started. The court will probably rule in June on the legality of Prop 8. I mean, nobody really knows how they're going to decide. There are many, many ways that the court could decide the case. I mean, they could, whether it's yes or whether it's no, whether or not to vote to overturn it. They could vote to overturn it and make, gay marriage legal across the country, or they could rule more narrowly, or they could, heaven forbid, they ruled that California voters were within their right to take the right of same-sex marriage away here in California. Heaven defend them from doing that, but that's always a possibility. So it's just sort of wait and see, I think. I kind of have mixed feelings. I mean, on the one hand, it would be great if the court would allow, since it's a fundamental right, why should we be campaigning for it at the ballot box? But at the same time, one good thing about campaigning is, is sort of opening the conversation with other Californians, and, progress can happen that way. If it comes to it if it ever comes to be a ballot measure again, I'm certainly raring to go. I would definitely be involved in that campaign, and that's something. One thing about campaigning, even though I thought it was a little insulting that I had to, I'm on a street corner begging for rights. I did feel very passionate about it. I'll be ready to fight for it if it ever comes to a ballot again here in California.
Yeah, I'm a campaign worker myself, and you know, I work for PIRG and for other, without talking about myself too much. And so I'm aware of the process, and I know that one cool thing about organizing and campaigning is that you really do get to see how things work. And I think a lot of Americans, a lot of people don't.
Yeah. So we'll just, we'll wait and see. It's amazing. Like I said, it's been, so it's been 4 years since Prop 8 passed. I mean, time goes by so quickly. It's just hard to believe that that amount of time has happened since Prop 8 has passed. So a lot of progress has happened since then. So, we'll just see what happens.
Yeah, it's so crazy how there's so much back and forth. Like, you see Washington voted for gay marriage, and then their big one of the biggest companies in the state, Boeing, comes out and says, we're not going to recognize this. And it just seems like it's just going to be back and forth.
Well, it's very hard on an emotional level, because on an intellectual level, you read the history books, and change, and the great lesson to learn is that change happens very, very slowly, and that's just the way it is. But try saying that, particularly in my case, the gay community's case, where the rights were taken away from them, it's just very hard to say, to look at these people and look at people in the face and say, okay, change happens very slowly, just wait your turn, when you want to have your rights now. Now-ish sort of culture. Yeah, you want your rights, you want them now.
It's not even about waiting, though. It's not about, it's not just this gift that comes, is bestowed upon you. You have to work, and you have to organize, and you have to make sure that your friends and family know what's going on, so that they can, if they're willing to lend a voice to this or put in a little effort for you. I mean, just, organizing your people is part of it, and it... I think it's a great exercise, but you don't just get to wait around. You actually have to work.
You can't, and ultimately that's what it comes down to. It comes down to choice. It's like, all right, how badly do you want to work for it? And at least on my level, I'm definitely ready to work. I'm certainly ready to work for it. Currently, my sense is that we're sort of holding our fire and sort of waiting to see what the Supreme Court says. Because if the Supreme Court overturns Prop 8, then gay marriage becomes legal in California, and that will be hopefully the end of it. I mean, we'll have a lot of people complaining, but that's just kind of tough darts for them.
Tough darts. Yeah, well, it's sort of like, the Citizens United case, which was upheld by the Supreme Court, and now there are a lot of states going for a constitutional amendment, which
campaign finance, that's a whole other kind of fascinating. I don't want to get into too much on non-related topics, but...
Oh, sure.
On that particular interest, it's kind of fascinating, especially in 2012, the decision is handed down. Now you have these, obscenely wealthy people just pouring gazillions of dollars into these, into the national election and senatorial elections and all this stuff, and they got very, very little return on the investment. So it's kind of interesting. The court opened, at least in 2012, court opened the opportunity for them to essentially waste their money. That said, though, big money is just such a corrupting influence in politics, which is frankly an understatement that, we'll just see how it all turns out. The truth always has a way of, the truth always seems to find a way. It's like, like a branch reaching for the sunlight or something like that. Courts can make decisions. Voters can make decisions. Ultimately, what is supposed to happen on a large scale, I believe that. Eventually, it happens.
Yeah. I'm kind of dreaming about what about a constitutional amendment to make gay marriage possible. Why not amend the Constitution? I mean, if it's that big of a deal.
Yeah, well, but I think what's going. But I think I think that's what we're hoping the Supreme Court will do. I don't think there is a need for the. I think.
Yeah.
Exists. I mean, it'll take a majority for the Supreme Court to sort of interpret the Constitution to recognize that that right really is there. I mean,
it exists. Yes.
Right. Exactly. I mean, the tradition of expanding rights for people is, a sort of that has been,
nice.
The gradual trajectory of, the history of this republic. So hopefully, gay marriage definitely fits into that trajectory. So that's why I feel hopeful, reading the history and looking at what happened in 2012 and looking, and just going forward, that I think gay marriage will eventually, sooner or later, will become the law of the land. And 100 years from now, people will just look back and wonder what all the fuss was about.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. My name is Kristen, and I'm speaking for Out Loud Radio with Chris Deliani. Is a San Francisco novelist at this point from Boston. We're talking about his new novel, You Are Here. It's a fantastic book. I highly, highly recommend that you read it. It's a great read. It'll make you feel good. It'll make you feel better. So where can you purchase the book?
The book itself won't be available, probably won't be on the shelf, but if you go into your favorite bookstore and you say you want to order the book, they should be able to find it and order it for you, no problem whatsoever. But if you do feel like going online, do be sure to visit me on my website, www.chrisdeliani.com. I try to, I've got a blog on that site, and I'm trying to keep it current.
KBOO is proud to be a media sponsor of An Evening with Dr. Michelle Alexander, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013, from 5 to 9 p.m. at Emmanuel Temple, located at 1033 North Sumner Street. Dr. Alexander is the author of The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration.